The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. It goes without saying that humans find sex fascinating. From publishing scientific studies to standing around the water cooler, we devote a huge amount of time and attention to discussing one of our most primal impulses. And one of the things we end up talking about most are the people who appear to deviate from what we think of as normal. Same-sex marriage, cheating spouses, open relationships, activities that diverge from the two-person monogamous heterosexual relationship norm. But is that the norm? Is the pair bond the natural human state? Where do we get that idea? And when do all the exceptions to the rule make something not really a rule anymore? In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Christopher Ryan, one of the authors of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. We also have a bit of news. The Independent Investigations Group in Hollywood, who have appeared on Skeptically Speaking in the past, are celebrating 10 years of hands-on investigation into paranormal and extraordinary claims. To commemorate the occasion, they're holding an anniversary party, complete with special skeptical guests and an award ceremony honoring those in the media who make positive contributions to science and skepticism. If you'll be in the Los Angeles area on August 21st, do pay them a visit at the Center for Inquiry. You can find all the pertinent details at iigwest.org. And please do accept our sincere congratulations on a decade of scientific inquiry. And now, to Speaking Up. We're here with two of my favorite people, Derek Colanduno and Robin Swoopy McCarthy, the hosts of the granddaddy of skeptical podcast, Skepticality. They're also the founders of the Dragon Con Skeptrack. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Desiree.
How you doing?
Very well. So for the not-quite-as-geeky listeners, can you explain the wonder that is Dragon Con?
Well, I think its better-known counterpart, although not any way affiliated, is Comic-Con. It's what's called a cultural convention, where basically a lot of it is science fiction and fantasy, but basically anything goes, and there are programming tracks that have information and panels and presentations and concerts going on 24 hours a day, every Labor Day weekend in downtown Atlanta, Georgia.
So you say science fiction and fantasy, so what does that encompass?
Oh, all the good stuff. There's Star Wars and Star Trek and Serenity and Babylon 5. And I mean, actually, basically everything. There's tracks for novelists, for authors, for costumers, for film production. There's a film contest. Yeah. They do a short film contest and they run anime rooms where they show nothing but anime constantly.
Yeah, they're doing an anime contest this year.
Basically anything, all your favorite television shows, all your favorite films, artists from comic books, all the stars from those films, and all of those authors come, people like Laurel K. Hamilton, who's quite popular right now. Last year, some of the big guests were William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy from Star Trek. And then we have some awesome practical science stuff where we have folks who work at NASA and the JPL who come. And we have solar telescopes and all sorts of great stuff. We make nitrogen ice cream and all sorts of fun, geeky things. The Mythbusters also come as part of the science fun stuff. There's robotics. There's a section dedicated to space. There's a section dedicated to podcasting. And now there's a section dedicated to skepticism.
So basically what you're saying is this is like geek mecca.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It was about 2 or 3 years ago before the new Batman movie came. They premiered it at Dragon Con.
So what does skepticism have to do with all this then?
Well, we like to say that there is no science fiction without the science. And so there's been a science portion of Dragon Con for many years since its inception, and Dragon Con is over 25 years old. Usually there was at least one panel dedicated to skepticism and critical thinking. It was always very popular, And we determined once we were invited to be a part of that in 2005 that we thought we could support a whole weekend full of programming with our favorite skeptics and skeptical topics. And the folks at DragonCon were kind enough to agree. And all of the folks that we know, like Dr. Phil Plate and Dr. Michael Shermer, came out that first year. And we had a really excellent turnout. And it's been very popular each year since then.
They gave us a bigger room, and then it went from there.
So it must be working out well, because there's a lot of copycats in the best way.
What's great is that we've been contacted by folks at other conventions, like Gen Con was just this last weekend, and they had some skeptical programming. And I know that Balticon and many of the other conventions that are similar now have skepticism as part of their programming. And that's awesome. We encourage everybody to do it. It's a really great way to introduce skepticism and critical thinking to a younger audience that may not have considered any of these concepts before, but find them really familiar once they start looking at them and applying them to some of their favorite sci-fi and fantasy topics.
And remember that a lot of good sci-fi, especially, was steeped in skeptical thought. Star Trek, from the beginning, was very skeptical.
There are incredibly interesting panels this year. I attended last year, and the panels were wonderful, but I think they're better this year, even. We have Skepticism, Scams, and Consumerism.
Yeah, that's going to be a great panel discussion, and it's going to have folks on it like Richard Saunders from the Skeptic Zone and Tom Merritt, who's actually a very popular podcaster who is a profoundly skeptical guy, and a lot of what he discusses on his program has to do with consumer protection. It's going to be really great. It's about the psychology behind sales to consumers and what your rights are as a consumer to be protected from these kinds of scams, which, of course, is a huge thing for skeptics. I think a lot of us consider consumer protection really one of the hallmark things that shows that skepticism and critical thinking can really help protect you. It's not just the paranormal, that there's some real good that can come from thinking critically.
Skepticism, at the heart of it, it was always consumer awareness, because it's the same thing. It's when Randy went on the Tonight Show and showed people what Popoff was doing so that people don't spend money to go see this guy who's obviously fake.
And on a completely unrelated direction, we have skepticism and sexuality.
We have one of those sexual talks by Sean Faircloth, director and person in charge of the Secular Coalition for America. I can't wait to see that one. He tells me it's going to be pretty good.
He's going to do another one that is more of an introduction to what the Secular Coalition does, which is something that a lot of people have heard. But he's also doing one called Secular Coalition Sex, Law, and Morality.
Yeah.
And he is going to discuss how religious attitudes towards sex have really tainted the way that many people, especially in the United States, make decisions in matters of public policy and government. I really hope that I'm going to be able to attend that one. But yeah, the racier sexual topic is the really cool panel lineup that has folks on it like Dr. Ginger Campbell, who does the Brain Science podcast, and psychologist Dr. Barbara Drescher, and our good friend Heidi Anderson, and some other folks. I think that's going to be really juicy. I think that's going to be unexpected to a lot of people.
Absolutely. And there's a lot to be skeptical of in terms of sexuality and a lot of the myths around it.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of this at TAM this year as well. For some reason, it's an issue that started to bubble up to the top in the skeptical community. It seems to be something that people want to learn more about lately.
There's also less sexy stuff for parents. It's not all about sex, people.
No.
That's what's great about DragonCon, because it does run basically all day and all night. There's lots of family-friendly programming, and in fact, daycare is one of the things that DragonCon provides. So we actually do get a lot of parents and younger people that attend during the daytime hours. But after 10 o'clock at night, there's a lot of more adult-oriented programming. And so we've got all sorts of different things that are scheduled now for SkepTrack, including fun stuff for kids and about magic and myths and paranormal investigation and all of that great stuff during the day. But then we have some of the more racy, interesting topics at night. So it's a lot of fun to be able to do stuff that's so diverse.
And our biggest, I think one of our biggest panels this year is going to be the parenting panel with Adam Savage and you and Heidi, Barbara Drescher, Daniel Loxon, skeptics who have kids. And it's going to be about raising kids as skeptics.
I am so looking forward to that. I cannot even articulate how much it is. So this really runs the gamut from panels that are basically skepticism 101 for all those people that just kind of meander in from DragonCon proper to panels that really want to explore some of the more advanced topics then.
Yeah, the thing is, we have a couple panels at the beginning of the first day that are more about general skeptical stuff. And then we have a couple that are basic stuff at the very last day. The first year we did SkepTrack, we had mixed in a bunch of the basic skeptical stuff like during the day. But as we went along, almost everybody that comes, there are people who want to learn more about it or know enough about it. They don't want the 101. They want topics. So we're trying to like strike a balance so that people can get into it without having to know everything. It's amazing how many people that come to DragonCon, even if they're not involved in skeptical thought, they know enough about it.
So this is really outreach for you guys then?
Oh, yes.
I think that was probably the number one reason why we decided that we wanted to do more of this, because we saw the potential there because of the huge massive number of people, which is approximately 40,000 over the weekend of DragonCon. There are children and young people. There are people interested specifically in science fiction things. There are people interested in costuming or martial arts or whatever. But they're basically there to just see what there is to see. And it was a huge well of people that were not involved in the skeptical community already. And so the interest that was shown even just by the few panels that were on the science track dealing with skepticism. And of course, every time the Mythbusters show up at DragonCon, it's standing room only. And this really told us that these people were ripe to have more interest in skepticism and would be interested in more programming. And since day one, they have. I think it's very rare that we haven't had mostly a capacity audience in the space that we're allotted, which is why each year the space keeps getting bigger. And so that's phenomenally exciting. DragonCon provides for us tables and stuff to be able to put out information, and nonprofit groups can be represented, like the Secular Coalition for America. And I know that the Skeptic Society is represented there, and Skeptic and CSI. There's lots of other different groups that bring their information to DragonCon. And we've heard that the response to that information and the feedback they get afterwards is big. So the kids are picking up the information and they're interested in it, which means it's working.
Well, how many people do you think come for the science fiction, but they really get interested in skepticism and end up being involved in the community after?
I know through our local group with the Atlanta Skeptics, we definitely have had some feedback from people who said, you know, they found out about this at DragonCon. Yeah. I would say the percentage is pretty good. I think it's definitely bigger than we anticipated, but yeah. I don't have any hard numbers on that. The room that we have seats
400 if you have the people sit on the sides. But
so for each panel, and we have panels that run from roughly 10 a.m. in the morning to about 2 a.m. the next morning for each day of the track, and if the room is full, so that ends up being quite a large cross-section of people.
We get about an average about 75% capacity. So
if people decide right now, after hearing you wax eloquently, that they cannot possibly miss DragonCon this year, what should they do?
How could they not?
To be honest, it's actually pretty difficult to say at this late date. However, it isn't impossible.
Oh, no.
I've been contacted by quite a few people over the last week or so who initially thought they weren't going to be able to come this year and who have changed their minds. So I would say that you should see if you can find somebody who's already going to attend that may have a hotel room to share with you, because that's the biggest difficulty in attending DragonCon. You can stand in line and get your membership the day of if need be, and you can find out about all of that stuff at dragoncon.org.
The best way to do it is call them and buy your membership ticket on the phone.
Do not despair. You could absolutely do it if you're just deciding right this minute that you want to come to DragonCon. It can be done. But, you know, next year, plan ahead.
Every year, it's the same dates. It's always Labor Day weekend. So we already have the venue locked down until 2014, maybe 2015. So,
and if people want to see the full schedule and the guest lineup for just the SkepTrack, where do they go?
SkepTrack.org.
There's a link to the schedule on the front, or you can go to SkepTrack.org/schedule. I think we even have, does Skeptic Track have a Facebook group? They do, don't they?
Yes, we do.
There's lots of great communication between the members. So again, if you haven't decided yet to come, talk to some people who've already been, and you can determine if it's for you and look over at the schedule and see if you find it interesting. I think it's fabulous, and I lament because I'm in the room next door running the podcasting track most of the time, and so I rarely get to see all the fun stuff.
I'm going to make you have to come over a few times this year.
Well, she's coming over once because Skeptically Speaking is doing a live show.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you so much for like adding me to your live show at DragonCon so that I can participate in some of the fun.
I love it, and I booked her ahead of time, people, so don't even think you can get in now. I am so excited that it's actually rather embarrassing. So thanks for being here, guys.
Oh, you're no welcome. Problem. Thanks so much for asking us.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking today with Christopher Ryan, Doctor of Psychology and Veteran of Unusual Occupations. He's gutted salmon in Alaska, taught English to prostitutes in Bangkok, and self-defense to land reform activists in Mexico. Drawing upon his multicultural experience, Christopher's research has focused on trying to distinguish the human from the cultural. He's the author of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Hi, thank you.
So let me start by saying thanks to you and your book. I've started far too many arguments about sex this week. Far too many. People have some opinions on this subject, and strong ones.
Yeah, no question about it. I've been talking about this stuff at cocktail parties for years, so I'm a grizzled veteran.
Well, many of the arguments that I was involved in were around the standard narrative of human sexuality. So maybe just start out by explaining what that typically is, the boy meets girl bit.
Sure. The standard narrative is that there is an essential exchange at the heart of female-male relations that breaks down to the female is trading sexual fidelity for goods and services from the man. This is the standard narrative that people propose as goes back to the beginning of our species. Obviously, I guess we'll talk about how our view differs from that standard narrative, but that's the central pillar of the narrative, that women are trading their sexual fidelity for meat and protection and status from men.
So every other mating-associated behavior is basically derived from that premise then?
Right. That's the central premise in the standard narrative. And so, yeah, you've got all sorts of different things that radiate out from that, like the fact that females are not particularly libidinous, which gives them an advantage in the negotiating process, and that, you know, females are women in our species are attracted to older men with more resources, more wealth, and so on and so forth. But see, all of these are projections of contemporary conditions into prehistory. And in fact, there was very little, if any, wealth to consider in prehistory. So that's just one example of where the standard narrative is mistaken.
Well, let's talk about some of the assumptions. First of all, the male parental investment. Now, what does that mean?
Yes, this is a corollary of that central exchange that's assumed in the standard narrative, where the idea is that men have always been obsessed with female fidelity because the sort of mathematics of mating, the way it breaks down, is that no man would want to be investing in another man's children. So it's very much an economic theory. But again, when you look at prehistory, what you find is that men weren't investing in the way that we envision it today because they didn't have wealth, they didn't have private property, and so on. So male parental investment is the amount of resources that a man or any male of any species is putting into the nurturing and care of the young.
And the other part of this is that women are also choosy about which men, as there's a greater risk to her, mainly through childbirth.
Right. Yes, it's a little confusing because there's male parental investment, MPI, and then there's another MPI, which is minimal parental investment, which also applies to females. And the idea there is that the woman's minimal parental investment is very high. because a woman looks at a sexual opportunity and thinks, well, if I get pregnant, that's 9 months out of my life where I'm going to be very vulnerable. And then I'll be breastfeeding and carrying a baby around for another few years. So it's a huge investment of her time and resources, personal resources. Whereas the male's minimal parental investment is, you know, a couple of minutes. It's pretty minimal.
So the idea is that men would basically have a harem if it wasn't for the fact that they desperately need to pass on their DNA and to be sure that the child is theirs.
Well, which idea? Our idea? No, we don't. See, the debate about sexuality normally breaks down into, saying women prefer monogamy, men prefer polygamy, prefer a harem. And we're sort of turning over that whole debate by saying, wait a minute, neither of those. Males and females are evolved to be casually promiscuous.
And that's interesting because this is not something that we hear on a regular basis. And I have read sort of snippets of this kind of thought process and these theories in some of the books I read. But to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time that this theory has been explored in this kind of depth.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to say it's completely a unique treatment because a lot of what we're talking about is based on theories and insights from Lewis Henry Morgan, who was the first American anthropologist who was writing at the same time as Darwin back in the 1870s, 1860s. But he didn't have the primatological information we have. He didn't have all the anthropological information. Engels also wrote about the way that women became property of men with the advent of agriculture. So a lot of the theoretical basis of what we write about in Sex at Dawn was covered a long time ago, but those theorists didn't have the amount of data that we've got now to really test those theories.
You mentioned economics. So now again, not your idea, but the standard narrative again, is that this is evolutionary economics. It's a cost-benefit analysis from both parties.
Yes, and zero sum.
Right. There's a part in your book where you actually, the section name is called Darwin Says Your Mother's a Whore.
Yeah.
Did you want to explain that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just a provocative summation of that aspect of the standard narrative that says that women, by their very nature, are trading sex for stuff, you know, whether it's, meat from the hunt, or it's shelter, or it's protection from other men, or it's, sort of glomming onto a man's status. The central behavioral motivation for women, according to this neo-Darwinian perspective, that's prostitution, right? It's trading sex for something that you want. So,
right,
yeah,
but
Darwin says your mother's a whore.
I love that line. Thank you. And I will use that often. But wouldn't that be an acceptable contract if both parties were buying into it? I guess the problem is that it appears that humans are not buying into it.
Right. Some species do function that way. But what you find when you look at human beings is that we are very far from any other primate species that functions that way. In fact, among the apes, there's only one monogamous ape, which is the lesser ape, is the gibbons in Southeast Asia. Among the African apes, there are no monogamous African apes. You've got humans, chimps, and bonobos, who are the most closely related among primates, or among apes anyway. And they're all promiscuous maters. I mean, people don't understand how closely related we are to chimps and bonobos. If you go to a zoo and you're standing there looking at the chimps in the cage, you're more closely related to those chimps than the chimps are to anything, to gorillas, to orangutans, to anything else in the zoo. They're more closely related to you. So we're very, very, in terms of DNA and in terms of how long since our last common ancestor, we're very close to chimps and bonobos.
But I guess the argument about that is that haven't we evolved past the point where we're actually that close? Should we be finding those kind of common characteristics?
Well, anytime you want to try to understand evolutionary past of a species, you want to look at the closely related species, if possible, and try to find commonalities among the two or three species that you're looking at. Because if you find a commonality, then you can surmise with considerable confidence that this characteristic was shared, was characteristic of the last common ancestor. So it's a lead. It's not definitive, but it's certainly a pretty strong hint at a very deep characteristic of a species. But as I say, it's not the only thing we do. What we do in Sex at Dawn is we sort of triangulate from several different angles. You know, primatology is one, and anthropology is another, and human anatomy is probably the most solid evidence that we rely upon in the book.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about the roots of human sexuality and whether we've had it wrong all along. Christopher Ryan, author of Sex at Dawn, is taking your questions. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So in that standard narrative, the conflicting objectives lead to jealousy. And from the man, it's due to if the woman has sex with someone else. But from the woman, it's due to the man betraying her emotionally.
Yeah, that's primarily based on the work of David Buss, who's done a lot of research on how male and female jealousy supposedly differs. And his findings seem to support that narrative.
But you have found many examples of different cultures where jealousy doesn't seem to be an issue. Therefore, it would seem to be not quite a natural emotion, as some people would like us to think.
Right. What we argue in Sex at Dawn is that jealousy is part of human nature to the extent that jealousy is an expression of insecurity. So, in other words, it's completely natural that we fear losing something that's precious to us and that we're afraid we can never replace. In societies where food is scarce, people are very protective of their food and fearful of losing it, right? And so what we argue in the book is that some societies, like the ones we survey as examples, downplay that expression of jealousy, and they downplay it through social mechanisms that make it seem ridiculous and shameful and pathetic. And they also downplay it because there's a surplus of affection and sexuality, so that people aren't really that worried about it. They don't take sex so seriously, so they don't think just because my special friend has sex with someone else, she's not my special friend anymore. You know, and then you look at other societies like ours, and you see the celebration of really obsessive thinking and obsessive behavior. We talk, for example, about the famous songs, some famous songs that celebrate this craziness, like When a Man Loves a Woman. Everyone knows the song, but if you really listen to the song, it's crazy. It says that a man loves a woman, he'll turn his back on his best friends, he'll spend his very last dime, he'll do absolutely everything this woman says, including sleep out in the rain, if she says that's the way it ought to be. That doesn't seem like love to me. That seems like a very abusive abusive relationship.
Well, let's talk about the complete opposite of that, the Mosuo.
Sure. The Mosuo are a very interesting society in China, who for several centuries have had a family system that really gives the lie to the standard narrative. Because, like, as we were saying about jealousy, if jealousy is universal in human nature, then it should exist everywhere. And so if you can provide several different examples of societies that really don't take jealousy seriously at all, then obviously it's not a human universal. The Moswo are fascinating because they defy the expectations in terms of parental investment we were talking about earlier. The way Moswo society works is that the mother owns the house. The property passes from mother to daughter. It's a matrilineal society. And the daughters have rooms in the house that sort of surround a courtyard. So each of the rooms opens onto the courtyard. And each room also has a door that opens into the street. So when a girl reaches sexual maturity, becomes a woman, she gets her own room. It's called a flower room, her flower room. And that's her bedroom. And she can invite any man she wants to join her for the night. The only rule is he has to be gone by morning. So nobody sticks around for breakfast. He has to be gone, but he can sleep there with her. When she has a child, the child is taken care of by her sisters and mother, and her brothers. So the woman's brothers assume paternal responsibility for the child. The biological father of the child is a complete non-issue.
Now, this is fascinating. You think that there is the potential that most, or let's say some humans, maybe even the majority of humans, lived in situations similar to these before we became an agricultural society?
Right. The theory we set forth in the book is that before agriculture, which was when private property entered into human life for the first time, human beings were nomadic, living in small, intimate groups of 150 or fewer people that shared virtually everything. Now, this isn't our theory. This is well known. Any anthropologist will tell you this about hunter-gatherers. They share food. They share shelter. They share child care. Women typically breastfeed one another's children. They share protection from predators and so on. Anthropologists refer to them as being fiercely egalitarian. Right. So they don't only share things, they insist on sharing things, which is, ironically, it's one of the problems anthropologists often have when they try to study hunter-gatherers, because the anthropologist doesn't want to share his recording equipment and his cameras and everything else he has. So the people get offended, because for them that's unheard of. That's very rude behavior to show up and live with us and not share everything with us. So anyway, all we're doing is extending that sharing and saying, well, if they're sharing childcare, they're sharing food, they're sharing everything else, they probably shared sex as well. So that's the hypothesis. And then when we look at the data, we see so much data supporting that hypothesis that it seems pretty clear that that's the way we evolved.
Well, you've also found some interesting benefits to living in these societies beyond just the unencumbered sex. Health benefits.
Oh, sure. It's important to understand that, you know, like earlier you were saying, well, we've evolved beyond this, and maybe, you know, maybe it's not relevant, chimpanzees and bonobos and so on. And to some extent, I understand that perspective. But it's very important to understand that any animal does best in the environment in which it evolved. So now, environments are always changing, always in flux. That's a given. But for example, if you look at diet, the best, healthiest diet for human beings is the hunter-gatherer diet. It's very low in fats, it's high in fiber, very nutritious. Hunter-gatherers keep their weight quite low, not because they're unhealthy, not because they're starving to death, just because they eat until they're not hungry anymore, and they tend to eat in small amounts throughout the day. They don't sit down to a big meal and so on. The best exercise pattern is a hunter-gatherer exercise pattern. It's sustained, low-intensity aerobic activity. Not a lot of sitting around, not a lot of even standing around. It's movement. So you look at the hunter-gatherer lifestyle and you see in many different respects the healthiest way for human beings to live.
And we have a question from the website.
If pre-agriculture human sexuality was adapted for that environment, why should we think that post-agriculture human sexuality is not adaptive or is not adapting towards a new optimal strategy, especially since selection will be more efficient with the larger effective population sizes enabled by agricultural production? Why should we assume that pre-agricultural strategies are adaptive for us as a species after such a dramatic environmental change, even if the process of change causes psychological distress now? That's from Josh in Cambridge, UK.
That's an excellent question and an excellent summation of the situation. We're not arguing in Sex at Dawn that anyone should change their approach to sexuality, or that, you know, a lot of people who haven't read the book sort of assume that we're advocating open relationships or commune style orgiastic approach to sexuality. And we're not at all. What we're hoping to do is give people a more informed sense of the sort of underpinnings of human sexuality so that they'll be able to make better decisions about how they want to approach relationships, how they want to deal with failures within themselves or within the relationship, or aberrations from what they set out to do. So we're not advocating any particular approach to this. All we're really trying to do is bring people to a more realistic sense of what human sexuality is, because the sorts of things we're talking about are very deep in the organism. They're very deep in our bodies. They're deep in our brains. And there hasn't been enough time in 10,000 years for those impulses to be wiped out. They're still in us. So how we deal with it is a separate issue, and everyone makes their own decisions along those lines. But they're still there. They're still quite strong.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're on the line with Christopher Ryan, author of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So the societies that we're talking about, these pre-agricultural, very egalitarian societies, would seem to be an ideal response to that men just want to have sex, but women just want emotional intimacy theory. But you're saying that that's not a correct theory at all.
Well, there's something to that. I have to say that in the accounts that I've read of hunter-gatherer society, you do see a difference in the way men and women talk about their sexual relationships. And I have to stipulate that, you know, it's kind of hard to get this data. Not many anthropologists are asking people about their love lives in this sort of detail. But the data that we've seen, women do tend to talk more in terms of friendship and relation, and, you know, he makes me laugh, or, you know, he's I like the way he smells. You know, smell is very important for women everywhere. And so there probably is something to that. But
Women would disagree that women don't like sex as much as men do.
Well, there are different ways to like things, you know. So it's a complicated thing to talk about, because you can't really say women don't like sex as much as men do. They like it differently. They like it in different situations. They just like it in different ways. And I think in the book we talk about how, you know, if you've got two people sitting down at the table to have dinner, and one of them just wolfs down the food ravenously and the other savors every mouthful, which one likes eating more? You know, you can't really say. They like it in different ways. So I think it's clearly inaccurate to say that women enjoy sex less than men.
Well, in your book, you talk about a test where men and women were monitored for their physical and also their stated arousal while watching sexual imagery.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Where, yeah, they showed, the scientist was showing a series of different video clips, some of which were explicitly erotic, people having sex, and others just a naked guy walking down the beach, and a woman working out in a gym, you know, and so sort of vaguely erotic. And I think there were also in that, if I'm not mistaken, there was a clip of bonobos having sex together.
Right.
And Yeah, and the men, well, everyone had like a dial they could turn to indicate how turned on they were. But then they also had a device that measured genital blood flow. So they were looking at how genital blood flow changed in reaction to different things. And what they found was that the men basically turned the dial in concert with the genital blood flow. So the men consciously agreed with what their body was saying in terms of what turned them on. But with the women, there was a lot of divergence between what their bodies were saying and what they were indicating with the dial. So whether that means that the women themselves were sort of unaware of what was turning them on, or whether they were ashamed to admit it, or who knows. But there does seem to be a bit of a disconnect between some women's perceived arousal and their actual bodily arousal.
Right. It's interesting that so many societies have gone to such lengths to subdue female sexuality. It's almost like there are two narratives happening. If women aren't sexual, why would there be the need to subdue that sexuality?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the need comes from the private property, right? Because with the advent of property, according to this theory we're proposing in Sex at Dawn, that's when men became obsessed with controlling female sexuality, because that was the only way to assure their paternity. And so now when you've got a farm, you've got houses, you've got domesticated animals and so on, it suddenly becomes very important to know that who your son is, and it's really your son because he's going to get all your stuff. So it becomes very a different way of thinking, you know, whereas before agriculture, when no one really had anything to pass along to their sons, it didn't matter if it was your son or not biologically. So the impulse toward it comes from agriculture. But to address your point, what's really interesting is that simultaneously they're saying female sexuality is a non-issue. Women really aren't that sexual. They're not really into it. They just do it to make the man happy. But at the same time, we've got clitorectomies. We've got stoning women to death in Iran for adultery. We've got corsets and chastity belts and all these extreme measures to control female sexuality, which seemingly wouldn't be necessary if it weren't a strong, very strong force.
And we have a question from the website on that topic.
In Chapter 18, you talk about clitorectomies in Western culture, particularly in the UK and in the US. Isaac Baker Brown in the UK, 1858, in the US as late as 1936. Do you think that people assume it's only for religious reasons and only in developing countries? And is that a problematic assumption? That's from Kylie Sturgis.
Yes, I think people are generally shocked when they read about that. And the sort of associated material in the book about the war on masturbation, with sewing boys' foreskins closed without even any anesthesia, it's really barbaric what was done to children very recently, as the questioner says, well into the 20th century in the United States and in England. I think it's interesting how we're so comfortable talking about the barbarism of these now it's Islamic societies primarily that are practicing clitorectomies, we don't talk about what's going on in our own societies or what's gone on quite recently. You know, we can talk about the Catholic Church, for example. You know, that's happening right now in Western societies. And it's another example of, you know, what happens when you have a religious philosophy that is in direct conflict with the biological reality of our species. You know, you repress a natural expression of an essentially healthy impulse, and it comes out in a very perverse and destructive way.
Well, on that note, we have a question from the chat room.
How prevalent do we think rape and sexual abuse were in the past? And that's from Heidi Anderson.
Well, I assume Heidi's talking about prehistory, prehistoric past, since that's the focus of our book. it's obviously impossible to say with any authority about that, but we can assume that it was very low for the simple reason that women and children enjoy very high status in most foraging societies. So assuming that our ancestors' social organization is reflected in contemporary hunter-gatherer societies, which is the sort of operating assumption in most theoretical we should tell your readers, by the way, or your listeners, that it's 2:30 in the morning where I am. So I apologize for these lapses in my thinking.
No, thank you very much for coming on so early in the morning.
Well, it's so late at night, actually, in Spain. But so we really don't think that that rape or child abuse would have been a big issue in hunter-gatherer societies in the distant past, simply because women and children experience have a lot of autonomy, a great deal of autonomy, and are highly respected. So you get that sort of abuse when women and children are considered property of men, and you get these very distorted power relationships. In the prehistoric societies, it's quite clear that with the kind of egalitarianism that I talked about earlier, it would have been very difficult to get away with something like that.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we take a second look at transhumanism. George Dvorsky of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and science blogger Greg Fish return to debate artificial intelligence and the singularity. And on Speaking Up, blogger Joey Habin shares her thoughts on the myths and misunderstandings about deaf culture. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Our guest is Christopher Ryan, author of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. So just to be clear, evolutionary psychology is somewhat speculative, correct? How do we really evaluate whether the standard narrative is correct or the non-monogamy model is?
Well, I think there are many different ways to look at that. As I said earlier, for example, human anatomy is a very important indicator of the way we evolved. If it were true that human beings evolved in monogamous nuclear families, as is assumed in the standard narrative, human testicles would be a fraction of the size they are. There's what you find in monogamous primates is that the testicles are very, very small. Not only monogamous, but polygynous, where there's only one male having sex with a female in any given ovulatory cycle. What happens is that there's no competition. There's no sperm competition with other males. So there's no need for a lot of sperm cells. The spermatic spermatogenic capacity is very low. So gorillas, for example, which are harem-based breeders, the testicles are about the size of kidney beans, and they're up inside the gorilla's abdomen. And a male gorilla's penis is about the size of your little finger. So you've got no evolutionary pressure on creating larger genitals or more sperm production capacity. Whereas in promiscuous species like chimps and bonobos, you have much larger testicles. A chimp's testicles are about the size of a chicken egg. So there's a big difference there. We're somewhere in the middle, and that's often, you know, it's very convenient, because if you argue that humans are promiscuous, you say, well, look, our testicles are so much bigger than gorillas, that proves it. And if you argue that humans are monogamous, you say, well, look, our testicles are so much smaller than chimps. That proves my point. So it's sort of been a standoff, but we sort of break that standoff down in the book because we show that the DNA in the body that responds most rapidly to environmental pressure is precisely the DNA controlling testicular development. So we hypothesize that our ancestors probably had much bigger testicles than we do now.
This is a fascinating show, sir.
I wish
the
I were
things
thinking
we
more
learn.
Clearly.
And we have another question from the chat room.
What does the study of prehistoric sex tell us about non-heterosexual sex? And that's from Jenna Marie Griffith.
That's an excellent question. What it tells us is that non-heterosexual interaction is not the big conundrum that it's often taken to be, because for our species, reproduction is not the main point of sex. And it's the same with chimps and bonobos. With bonobos, you find so much sexual activity that is non-heterosexual. Virtually every combination you can imagine except mother-son. That's the only taboo in bonobo society. So once you envision sexuality for human beings as a social interaction that's about building and maintaining social networks, not primarily about reproduction, then homosexual activity is a non-issue. It doesn't. It's just as much a non-issue as primatologists studying, primates when they talk about grooming behavior. You know, they don't say, "Ooh, that's homosexual grooming behavior between two males or two females."
Right.
It's grooming behavior, which has a very important social function among primates, and in our species and closely related species, so does sexuality. So it's a non-issue. In fact, E.O. Wilson, who's sort of the father of evolutionary psychology, which earlier was called sociobiology, he himself said very clearly that for human beings, sex is primarily a bonding device. It's not primarily about reproduction.
We have another question from the chat room.
What do you make of women in developed countries today buying sex from men? Are our evolutionary rules starting to change? And that's from Greg Fish.
That's an interesting development. We talk about that in Sex at Dawn to some extent, the female sex tourism in Jamaica and Ghana and Turkey and Bali and other places. I think it's interesting both that it happens and happens quite a bit because it's an expression, it appears to be an expression of a changing morality, certainly, that these women are willing to do this. It's also an expression of female libido. You know, it sort of gives the lie to what we were saying earlier about how women just aren't interested in sex. But it's also interesting that it happens in a different way than, you know, it's not like the typical Amsterdam woman in a window situation or the Thailand, the women dancing on a stage with a number and the men pick the, you know, I want number 27. It's nothing like that. When women are in the sex tourism, generally the way it works is that, you know, the women go to Jamaica or Bali or wherever they're going, and they meet a guy on the beach or at a club or whatever, and he hangs out. They have that one guy will be with them for the length of their visit. And it's not money for sex per se. It's more like, oh, you need help, fixing your car. I'll lend you some money to fix your car. Or, you know, your brother doesn't have enough money to get through this semester at school. Let me help out your brother. So it's a very different kind of situation where it's much more relational, and there's not a direct exchange of sex for money in most cases. So I think it's a very interesting thing to look at and think about.
And last question, and it's from the chat room.
Given that sex and procreation are disconnected these days, why are the sexual taboos still in place? Why isn't sex the same as playing racquetball? And that's from Jeff Wagg.
Playing racquetball. Well, some taboos are still in place and some aren't. Of course, you know, we just talked about one that seems to be falling away. So we're definitely in a time of flux in terms of taboos. We see, for example, this court case in California with asserting the right to gay marriage, and where I live in Spain, gay rights are more advanced than they are in the United States. I think Canada is probably more advanced than the United States as well. So it's not clear that they're all in place, but you know, we live in a society in which private property is the prime motivator. And so if our theory is correct that a lot of these taboos relate to economics more than they do to underlying, you know, universal aspects of human sexuality, then it would make sense that a lot of these taboos would still exist because the economic system still exists that gave rise to them.
And we are out of time. Thanks very much for being here, Christopher.
It's been my pleasure. Let's do it a little earlier next time.
Agreed. And you can find Christopher and his book at sexatdawn.com. And as always, you can find us at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, follow the links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
This is Heidi Anderson from the women's critical thinking blog, shethought.com. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how I've used critical thinking in the area of sexuality. I grew up not really trusting instincts and hormones as far as making sexual decisions. And it seems very logical to me that if people are going to use critical thinking and skepticism to make decisions about consumer purchases, alternative medicine, paranormal claims, and all of the other things, that people could use skepticism and critical thinking when making sexual decisions, but also when teaching sexuality to other people, such as children. An example of this would be, it used to be considered correct practice to teach people that if they thought they were going to be engaged in risky sex, that it would increase their safety if they would use two condoms instead of one. But long-term studies showed that that actually increased the chances of the condoms tearing and diseases being able to pass through that tear. Another example would be that it used to be standard practice to tell women to use condoms with non-oxynol 9 in the lubricant. And again, studies showed that that particular lubricant actually irritated the vaginal walls and made it more likely for women to be susceptible to viruses and bacteria. Most recently, there's been another issue with the lube, which is that there are certain lubes that make it more likely that bacteria will grow because they are sugar-based. And healthcare practitioners are now struggling to get the message out of what particular ones are okay to use. I also kind of take it a little bit further and like to think that if we would use sex education as a way to teach critical thinking and let kids know that this is something that you can apply even to this area in your life. You would not make decisions on your health or your finances if you were completely drunk. And therefore, it would seem only logical that you wouldn't make sexual decisions also while you were drunk. But right now, we focus more on the morality of the issues with sexuality than we do on the evidence-based science of sexuality. So this is an area that has interested me for a long time and something that I'm hoping to get contributors to explore more on shethought.com.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds, and shams.
times a charlatan. Who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.